I didn't know much about money growing up. I got my first job and just kind of spent it. With Acorns Early, your kids don't have to get their money lessons the hard way. Start taking small steps today. Let them learn by doing and watch their potential grow for tomorrow. Because no matter what your kids grow up to be, they're going to have to deal with money, so you might as well start building those skills now. With Acorns Early, they can learn by doing and watch as the small steps they take today grow into big potential for tomorrow. Acorns Early lets kids learn by doing. They can earn money with the in-app chores tracker, practice real-life budgeting with automatic allowances, and even set their own savings goals. We've been using it for our youngest and he loves it. He feels so special having his own debit card, and I can really see him prioritizing the things that he wants to buy. Ready to join over 1.2 million parents and kids who've unlocked their kids' potential with Acorns Early? Get your first month on us when you head to acornsearly.com/ATTWG or download the Acorns Early app. That's 1 month free when you sign up at acornsearly.com/ATTWG.
Acorns Early Card is issued by Community Federal Savings Bank, member FDIC, pursuant to license by MasterCard International. Free trial for new subscribers only. Subscription fee starting from $5 per month unless canceled. Terms apply at acorns.com/early terms.
Have you ever had a gut feeling about someone and ignored it? In the thriller Ask for Andrea by Noelle W. Eiley, that feeling could be the difference between life and death. And it may also be a message from the other side. So Ethan read this book even before I did and has a lot to say about it.
Cover to cover, I could not put this book down. It is such a page turner. It is an intense read. It takes you from one point of view to another and culminates in a very intense finish that keeps you on the edge the entire time.
So basically, it's three women were murdered by the same man, and they unite in the afterlife to stop him from killing again in a domestic thriller that meets The Lovely Bones. If you've ever screamed at a true crime doc, why didn't anyone listen?
This is the book to read for that.
Ask for Andrea by Noelle Eiley.
Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's revolutionizing how we deal with life's challenges, from sleepless nights to stress-filled days. Mood.com has created an entire line of functional gummies that target specific health concerns with 100% federally legal THC blends. Even better, you can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code ATTWG. If you're like me, then you have different family members who have different ailments, and I've recommended Mood to all of them. I legitimately, before recording this, I told my mom about Mood, and she's going to make her first order. Because they have gummies for all sorts of things, for pain relief, for sleeping, for just improving your mood. Their gummies are specially blended and each one feels different. The Sleepy Time gummies knock me out in 15 minutes flat with no hangovers, no grogginess, and I wake up feeling amazing. And each gummy is crafted using federally legal cannabis grown on small, family-owned American farms. Best of all, not only does Mood stand behind everything with an industry-leading 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but, as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code ATTWG. So head to Mood.com, browse their amazing selection of functional gummies, and find the perfect gummy for whatever you're dealing with. And remember to use promo code ATTWG at checkout to save 20% on your first order.
Darkcast Network. The light shines brightest on our indie podcasts.
It's 5:30 a.m. and a woman is on her way to work. She left her home in Haworth, York, England at the same time and took the same route she had been taking for weeks, ever since her car broke down. But on this particular morning, March 19th, 2009, 35-year-old Claudia Lawrence didn't make it in. Police are confident that she left her home that morning, but something happened in the 1.5 miles between her home and the University of York's main campus where she worked as a chef. Over the years, there have been many theories. Was it a lover, a jealous partner, a serial killer? Someone took Claudia Lawrence, and after 14 years, her family has not given up on finding answers. With new leads and tips steadily appearing, will this be the year they finally get those answers? When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell you the stories of those who never came home.
Today, I want to tell you the story of Claudia Lawrence. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Everyone.
Welcome back.
Thank you for joining us once again. The UK and Canada are often duking it out for spots 2 and 3 in our listenership.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yes. So I'm going to try to branch out and cover more cases, like not just there, but from other countries outside of the US this season. Claudia Lawrence's story brings us to England this week. And one thing I find interesting about cases like this is how it highlights the similarities and differences between the way the U.S. covers missing persons cases and the way that other countries cover them. There are a lot of similarities for sure, but the differences in this case especially are pretty striking. But I'll be interested to, get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I'm interested to hear what the differences are.
And we have covered the Leah Croucher case, and that investigation is kind of similar to this. But we'll talk about it. So if you, dear listeners, have a case that you'd like us to cover, either domestically or internationally, I have finally launched the Google form that I was talking about, and you can find the link in the show notes. So you just fill that out. It'll go into a spreadsheet. So that way everything will be in one place. And so that's where I'm going to be looking for case suggestions from now on, just so they're all together and I won't forget about them. So that is there. Please look in the show notes. But for now, let's get to the case of Claudia Lawrence. Claudia Elizabeth Lawrence was born on February 27, 1974 in Malton, North Yorkshire, England, to Peter and Joan Lawrence. Claudia was the second of two children and has an older sister named Allie. The Lawrence family is one of privilege. Peter was a solicitor who did quite well for himself, and Claudia's mother, Joan, was also a prominent member of the community, serving on the Malton Town Council and eventually as mayor. They did divorce, when Claudia was a teenager, but it seems as though everybody stayed pretty close. Claudia attended the York College for Girls, a private school founded in 1908 by the Church Schools Company. Though the company was formed to educate young women based on primarily Anglican principles, it's now non-denominational. Claudia developed a love for cooking, and after graduation, she attended a local catering college where she studied to be a chef. Though she really enjoyed traveling, Claudia stayed nearby after graduation. She worked at various hotels and restaurants around York, but eventually wanted a position with better hours. It doesn't sound like she was really a night owl, and of course, like hotels and restaurants, like you're not getting the best schedule with that. In 2006, she found a job at the University of York's Goodricke College. The next year, she bought her own home, an adorable cottage in Haworth, about a mile and a half from campus. And it's like super old and brick, and it's exactly the type of place you would love.
This is countryside England.
I mean, kind of like small townish.
Yeah.
No, and I'm about to describe her life, and like literally she's living your dream. She was outgoing and popular. Claudia was social, but, you know, she wasn't on the marriage and kids track. In 2009, she had a great job, a great house, plenty of friends. She traveled and she had no shortage of male company. Claudia was kind of a partier, but not the type who liked to stay out at clubs until all hours, hence the job switch. She preferred to keep it low key and spent many evenings just hanging out at her local pub, the Nag's Head.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is my dream.
I know. She would meet men there and have flings, but seemingly never really got involved seriously with any of them. Honestly, like, it does sound like she was living a pretty sweet life.
Yeah.
Just like, solid job, her own house, doing whatever the hell she wanted. The problem is that not all of the men with whom she was having dalliances were single at the time. Claudia's father, Peter, gave an interview to the Yorkshire Post in 2019 where he talked about how this had created some what he called awkward situations. Nag's Head, the pub, was in a small suburb and everyone knew everyone. Peter said, quote, "If you think of any relationships at the Nag's Head, both the man and the woman are going to be there," end quote. So, you know, that makes it a little bit harder to have an affair.
Well, yeah. I mean, plus, if she's regularly going home with different guys from the same pub and everybody is in there, like, knows each other.
Yeah.
Like, you know, people are going to pay attention and notice those things.
Exactly. Peter went on to say, quote, "Claudia was given a bit of a hard time by one or two of them," meaning the wives or girlfriends, "but I don't think there were physical attacks," end quote. What makes this a little difficult is that it sounds as though this was information that Claudia's family really had to kind of put together later. I mean, she was understandably private about her dating life. Like I said, none of these guys were serious. They weren't somebody that you would, you know, be taking home to meet your parents. And she was in her mid-30s. So, like, she's not going to tell her family about every random hookup she has, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So, like, she was close with her family, but she definitely compartmentalized.
Yeah, well, it's like you said, that's not a part of your life that you share with your parents.
Yeah, exactly. So Claudia's job at the college was an early shift, so typically 6 to 2. On March 18th, 2009, she set off to make the mile and a half walk to work. She typically drove, but her car had recently broken down, and so it was in the shop. She had started walking to and from work and had been doing that, it sounds like, for a couple weeks. So that morning, on the 18th, she arrived on time for her 6 a.m. shift. After getting off of work a little after 2, she changed out of her work clothes and left the canteen on the university's main campus. She can be seen on CCTV wearing jeans and carrying a backpack. Now, there are a few different ways for Claudia to get home from work, but the most direct route is via Melrose Gate. Now, it's here that Claudia is seen on another CCTV camera in front of some shops at 2:47 p.m. And all of this makes sense because that's exactly where she should be given the time that she left campus. Shortly thereafter, a friend from work drives by and offers Claudia a ride home. She accepts, and Claudia's dropped off at her house around 2:50.
According to...
the lady who dropped her off, her friend.
Okay.
Yeah, so she says she dropped her off. She went in at 2:50, but it seems like Claudia might have just dropped her bag because she and gone back out because she was seen shortly thereafter walking in the direction of Nag's Head. But she didn't stay out very long. It doesn't even sound like she necessarily even went to Nag's Head. She was just going in that direction because by 3:10, she was spotted by a separate acquaintance heading back home. Now, it doesn't sound like Claudia went anywhere else that evening after she was seen going home at 3:10. It was a Wednesday, and she had to be up at 5 the next morning. So, you know, she had a pretty chill kind of evening in at home planned. She spoke with her parents on the phone, and she and her mom talked about a TV show that Claudia was watching. Claudia was on her cell phone, but Joan could tell that she was actually home because she could, like, hear the TV in the background, you know, playing the show that they were talking about. And, you know, it's just a boring conversation. They're making plans because Mother's Day is closer to March than it is here. Like, so they were making plans for that. Oh. According to friends and family, Claudia would often go to bed around 9 p.m. on the days that she had to work early. And that night, Claudia texts Susie Cooper, her best friend, at 8:23 p.m. about an upcoming vacation that they were planning. And that was like the last outgoing text or phone call for that night.
Is that the last known communication from her? All together? Is there any evidence of her actually leaving her house the next day?
Yeah, so I'm getting to that.
Okay, so jumping the gun here.
Yeah. there was an incoming text that came in that night at like 9:15 or something like that, but she didn't answer it. So it really does, just based on her normal routine and based on her phone usage, it really seems like she was hanging out at home, went to bed at around 9, and, you know, that was that. What is not consistent with her normal routine is that when the kitchen staff at the canteen at Goodrick began to prepare for their day at 6 a.m. the next morning, there was no Claudia. Claudia was not a no-call, no-show type of person. I mean, this is not like an average wait staff job or anything like that. Like, she was a chef, you know?
Yeah.
This is a career.
Right.
And so her boss was obviously concerned. He tried calling Claudia, but didn't get an answer. And then, you know, what are you going to do? Everybody just kind of proceeded with their shift as normal. Now, this is March 19th now that we're talking about. Claudia had made plans that evening to meet up with her friend Susie, the one that she had been texting.
Right.
They were meeting that evening at Nag's Head. So Susie gets there, but no Claudia. Assuming that Claudia was just running late, she texted her, but the text went unanswered. Susie tried calling, but the phone went straight to voicemail. Now, at this time, Susie, of course, had no idea that Claudia didn't show up for work. So she just thought that Claudia's phone died, or like she fell asleep, or, you know, just something along those lines. Uh-huh. So she's like annoyed, but not worried. But the next morning, Susie tried calling Claudia to see what had happened the night before, but she still couldn't get in touch with her.
And this is on the 20th at this point.
Yeah, so now we're on the 20th. And so this is when Susie becomes genuinely concerned. Thankfully, she had Peter's contact information, Claudia's dad. So she called him to let him know what was going on and like see if he knew anything or, you know, what. Peter had just talked to Claudia Wednesday evening, so like he hadn't been worried prior to this phone call. I mean, you know, he had just talked to her less than 48 hours ago, but Susie's story certainly alarmed him. He obviously tried to call Claudia, couldn't get through, and after not being able to reach his daughter, Peter called the university and discovered that Claudia hadn't made it to work since the 18th, and that's, of course, when he realized that something was terribly wrong. Now, remember when I said that Nag's Head was Claudia's neighborhood pub?
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is, you'll die of jealousy here. It's actually only about three doors down from her cottage.
Come on.
I know. Because it was so close, she had become friends with the Nag's Head landlord, which is what they call, I think, just like the guy who runs the bar.
Sure.
But it's a man named George Foreman.
No relation to the boxer, I'm
assuming. I assume not. Peter was heading down to Hayworth, but knew that George was obviously a lot closer. So he called and asked him to go over and check on things. George did. You know, he went and knocked on the door, but received no answer. When Peter arrived with a spare key, both men entered the cottage, and what they saw inside was a completely normal scene. Claudia's slippers were placed neatly by the stairs. Her jewelry was in its place, and her purse was there with her passport, her bank cards, and other, you know, important documents. Now, you know, when I first read that in one of the articles, I was like, oh God, no, her purse is there.
Standard, like, oh, she left on her own and is starting a new life.
Right. And, you know, left all of her stuff behind. But it turns out that Claudia usually left the purse at home when she went to work, instead opting to just carry her necessities and a change of clothes in the backpack that I mentioned earlier.
So was the backpack there?
Backpack was not there. Nothing in the home indicated a break-in or a violent struggle or anything of that nature. In fact, there were even dishes in the sink that indicated she had eaten breakfast before she left. The only things missing from her home that they could tell were her uniform, her backpack, her cell phone, and a hair straightener. And now the hair straightener, she apparently didn't usually take to work with her, so that was slightly odd.
Right, but she had plans to meet her friend at the pub.
Exactly.
So maybe she was going to get changed, straighten her hair, and go straight to the pub after work.
Yeah. Yeah, because I never read what time they were supposed to meet each other. They were probably going to be meeting later, assuming that Susie has like more of a 9-to-5 job. You know, she would have still been at work, and everything I read said they were supposed to meet that evening, and Claudia would get off at 2. But that's not to say she either A, was just going to go to the pub early.
Yeah.
Or B, she had other plans
in between.
In between, right.
Yeah.
But basically, everything is indicating that
she left for work that day.
Yeah. That whatever happened to her didn't happen the night before. So given that people spoke with her on the evening of the 18th, and she apparently went to bed, woke up, ate breakfast, gathered her things, and went to work, we're really working with a pretty narrow timeline.
For something to happen, yes.
Exactly. That's what I mean. So between 5:30 to 6 a.m. on Thursday, March 19th, because she usually
didn't show up for work.
Yeah.
Yep.
So she usually got up at 5. Usually left the house by 5:30, and then the walk was about 20 minutes, give or take.
Right.
And yeah, not only did she not show up to work, you know, her coworkers didn't see her like outside of the canteen or anything like that.
I'm assuming the police looked into CCTV footage.
Oh yeah, we're going to get
on the morning of.
Yep, we're going to get into all of that. Okay.
Because you mentioned that they have CCTV footage of her going home.
Yep, they do.
But they don't have any.
Well.
Okay.
Well, yeah. All right. So Peter figures out quickly that they are dealing likely with this, you know, narrow kind of timeline in which something would have happened. But he doesn't know what happened, right? Like, he's thinking that maybe she was injured or something, like she got hit by a car on her walk or something like that. And maybe she's, you know, in a hospital unconscious somewhere.
Sure. Assuming she doesn't. You said her purse was there with like her passport and ID and stuff like that.
No, not necessarily. No, her passport, but I don't think her ID. Okay. I think she probably had her ID with her.
Okay.
But, you know, in any case, like, he doesn't know what to think. Like, he's just trying to go through all of the scenarios. So around 2 p.m. that day, the 20th, Peter called the North Yorkshire police to report his daughter missing. Police did meet with Peter at Claudia's home, but I don't know at what time. All I've been able to find is later that day. They were, unsurprisingly, pretty disinterested in Claudia having come up missing, as she was a single adult. There were no obvious signs of foul play, and she was not what police would term a vulnerable individual. They did the whole thing of like, oh, she'll be back, I'm sure. You know, she probably just went off with a boyfriend or whatever. Nevertheless, they did agree to check her route to work, although I am unclear based on the news articles if that happened that day or on the 21st. Either way, it does seem as though the investigation began in earnest that weekend. On March 21st and 22nd, police made a public appeal for information and put up missing persons posters. By Monday, Claudia was on the front page of the local newspaper. The appeal and the publicity did bring in a few leads. A cyclist reported seeing a couple on Melrose Gate Bridge at 5:35 a.m. The man was described as skinny, about 5'6", and wearing a dark hoodie. Approximately 30 minutes later, a second witness noticed a couple outside of the university who appeared to be arguing. They were near a car with the passenger side door open, like the car was parked. Passenger side door was open, but they were out of the car. And the man was wearing a black hoodie.
But there was no mention of the car from the witness on the bridge?
Correct. If you just take the two sightings on the bridge and near the university, which after, you know, so many years and people going over this, like, do seem pretty credible, especially because, like, the two different witnesses who called it in gave very similar descriptions of the couple, including the fact one of them said, I believe it was the second witness, the one near the university, who described the woman as having mousy brown hair, which is interesting because the photos that had been released of Claudia up to that point, she had more blondish hair, like it was highlighted. So the description didn't necessarily match the photos that had been circulating, but did match what Claudia actually looked like at the time.
Interesting.
You know, the fact that that argument outside or near the university took place at around 5 after or 10 after 6 is also interesting to me because that would make sense why none of her coworkers saw her. So she had been kind of like walking with this man, arguing with this man, doing whatever. She's late for work at this point. So you got to think all of her colleagues are already inside. They're already getting ready. They've started their shift. So it makes sense that if that was her arguing with this dude outside, that nobody who she actually knew would have seen her. And it's early enough that, like, there aren't a ton of people out. So it's less likely that, you know, she would run into acquaintances or other people like she did on her way home from work the previous day.
Right. Did the second witness who saw them at the university have any description about the car?
I didn't see
yeah,
okay. A description of the car.
I mean, maybe the police asked and got some sort of vague description and they just didn't release it, but who knows?
Yeah. But getting back to the car, you know, I said the thing about Melrosgate Bridge is that the route that Claudia normally took would have put her on the bridge around that time. So if we are believing that both sightings are correct, like the man could have had a car, he could have not been with Claudia beforehand at her home. He could have been coming from his home or wherever, but knew how she got to work or just knew her and happened upon her randomly. But in either case, like he could have gotten out of the car. He could have seen her on the bridge, gotten out of the car to talk to her. And said, hey, like, why don't I give you a ride to work or whatever, right? So that could explain that second sighting near the parked car, but it could also explain why it doesn't appear that Claudia passed the CCTV camera by the shops on Melrose Gate that she passed the afternoon before. So that's the thing. She never shows up on that camera.
Would those cameras show a street view of the vehicle passing?
No. I've seen that video. It's you just see the sidewalk.
Hmm. Interesting.
Additional CCTV footage captured a Ford Focus that was seen around this time driving on Hayworth Road. Now, this camera that caught this video is basically like at the end of the block. So it's several houses away from Claudia's house. But you see this car passing by. And then it breaks suddenly, seemingly right in front of Claudia's house.
And what time was this?
This is around like 5:45. Like this is around this whole time. So the car breaks suddenly, but then it goes out of frame. So you can't tell if it like just kept on driving off into the distance or if it actually parked or what. Unfortunately, after all of this information was released, no one came forward claiming to be the man or the car driver in any of these sightings. The investigation plodded along after this, of course, with the requisite theories and speculation. The first theory that police put forth, of course, was that Claudia just decided to take off and start a new life, either with a man or to take a new job somewhere. In September of 2009, police actually traveled to Cyprus on a tip that she might have gone there because she had apparently visited there frequently and had talked to people about getting a job there. But that turned out nothing. So the theory about her just running off, I mean, her parents, of course, are like, no, this is very out of character. That's not what she would do. And, you know, those cases also are typically short-term mysteries, typically. So as the weeks passed with no word from Claudia, like, that theory was dismissed. Now, the other theory was that she was the unfortunate victim of a serial killer or some other wandering murderer. While there was no direct proof of this, there had been reports of people in the area who had been acting suspiciously in the days leading up to Claudia's disappearance. While that theory was backburnered, it does come back into play later on in the investigation. So just keep that in the back of your head. The final theory, and the most likely, is that Claudia was taken by somebody she knew. She either left her home willingly with that person or encountered them on her walk to work. This quickly became the primary theory as investigators began to dig deeper into Claudia's life and as they continued their investigation. Over the next month, police knocked on doors, performed searches, and interviewed hundreds of witnesses. Now, much of the following information that I'm going to get into wasn't released to the public at the time, but we'll talk about it here since the police did know this early on. One of the main avenues of investigation was Claudia's cell phone, which was missing along with her backpack. Claudia's boss called her around 10 a.m. on March 19th to see why she hadn't made it to work that morning. That call pinged off of a cell tower near the university. The phone was then deliberately switched off at 12:08 p.m. and never turned back on. Based on the available data, the cell phone never left the York area while it was still operational.
Okay, wait. So you said that, was it her phone that pinged off of the cell tower? Wasn't it also proven in the Adnan Syed case that incoming phone calls are not a good source of triangulation?
Yeah, but I mean, it's still good enough that, like, it won't ping in York if it's actually in Scotland, you know? Like,
yeah.
It'll get you close enough.
Okay. And how can they tell that the cell phone was deliberately turned off?
You know, I had the same question, but they were very
adamant about it.
Yes.
All right. I didn't know that was something that
I didn't
could
know.
Be tracked remotely.
Yeah, I don't know. But yeah, police have been adamant that it was deliberately switched off, not that it died or whatever.
And the time given for that was 12:08?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Maybe there is a way.
I don't know.
We obviously are not cell phone experts, you know, but that just does seem kind of odd to me.
Yeah. On April 24th, 5 weeks after she was last seen, police held a press conference and announced that Claudia's disappearance was being treated as a suspected murder investigation. Crime Stoppers UK offered a £10,000 reward for information that could lead to conviction of the person or persons responsible. Unfortunately, the reward didn't lead to a lot of new information. Claudia's home had been forensically examined, and investigators found no evidence of a struggle, blood, cleanup, or anything that would indicate that whatever happened to Claudia happened there. This, combined with the witness statements and the other evidence, pointed strongly to Claudia being harmed by a man she knew and trusted. Claudia's family, especially her father Peter, continued to bang the drum and keep her case at the forefront of people's minds. North Yorkshire police also continued to investigate new tips and leads that came in. Right around the one-year anniversary of Claudia's disappearance, they performed a search of an area near York University known as the Outgang.
That sounds very British.
Yeah. The search, which police said would take up to 3 days, was directly related to a tip they received after the one-year public appeal that police made. Part of that appeal was also asking for more information about Claudia's whereabouts on the night of March 16th going into the morning of the 17th.
Why?
Well, one of her work colleagues reportedly told investigators that Claudia may have spent the night with an unknown man the night of the 16th and spent the night and stayed out till 5 a.m., like basically all night. And then, you know, went right into work and was obviously exhausted.
which would explain why the evening of the 18th, she just went home.
Yeah, she was like still recovering, probably.
Yeah.
The thing is that this coworker didn't like tell police about this initially. This came much, much later. In that first year of the investigation, there had never been a man who they interviewed or who had come forward and said, oh, yeah, I saw her, you know, the night of the 16th. We were dating. We were whatever. By this time, everyone was getting frustrated. Peter was getting frustrated with what he called police's, quote, bunker mentality, and accused officers of being, quote, uncivil, rude, abrupt, and dismissive, end quote, toward Claudia's friends. So I didn't really know what he meant by a bunker mentality, because that is not something that I've heard before in relation to an investigation. Like usually you hear about like tunnel vision or, you know, things like that.
Yeah. Is that a British term that we don't know?
I think so. Because I finally did figure out later in the article that it seems as though it means that, like, Peter thought that police were retreating from the public eye in the case to the case's detriment. So, like, for instance, they refused to cooperate with a Channel 4 documentary about Claudia, and they weren't responding to Claudia's friends and relatives in a timely manner. So, like, friends and relatives had, you know, called in suggestions for searches or people to talk to or things like that, and, like, they either weren't being responded to at all or, you know, just not in a timely manner. So I think that's what that kind of means, is they are heading to the bunker, you know.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Yeah. Closing ranks. Investigators were becoming increasingly frustrated with the men with whom Claudia may have been involved because they weren't coming forward out of fear of getting caught cheating. In fact, The Guardian had a great headline on October 17th, 2009. Police tell secret lovers of missing chef Claudia, come forward or we will reveal your affair.
I love it.
Yeah. Detective Superintendent Ray Galloway told reporters, quote, it inhibits the progress of the investigation. We have got to the point where there is definitely frustration in the investigation team as a result of some men who are less than candid when we approach them, end quote. He went on to say, quote, the opportunity for people to meet us halfway is a perishable one, and we have got to the point where we will just knock on doors of people who won't come to us, end quote.
As a side note, I do think that the British law enforcement titles and ranks are just, they just sound so much better than
ours. Oh, they do. They sound so freaking cool. Like
Detective Superintendent.
Yeah.
DI.
DI. Mm-hmm.
Like, that sounds so much cooler than my title.
Yeah. No, for sure.
Like, special agent. But Detective Superintendent.
Yeah.
It just sounds so cool.
Well, yeah, and it's like here, you just steal all your shit from the military. It's like, ooh, sergeant and lieutenant and like whatever. It's like boring.
Yeah.
Like just let the military have their thing. But whatever. Anyway. According to Galloway, there were several men with whom police wanted to question. The issue is that they were still piecing together who exactly the men were who they wanted to question. So they knew like personal details about these guys and in some cases nicknames, but
not their real names.
Nope.
Oh boy.
Yeah. And they weren't coming forward. So this handful of men represented the gaps in the relationship chart, which is what the detectives called it, that they had put together, which included 12 men with whom Claudia had been involved in the 5 years prior to her disappearance. And these 12 men, they were able to talk to and kind of figure out. Then there was like this, quote, handful of men who were just kind of off in the ether somewhere. The higher ups in the North Yorkshire Police Department were also getting frustrated by the lack of progress in this case. By the one-year mark, the inquiry had already cost more than £600,000 and had been the subject of an internal audit. They were so flummoxed by this case that they even sought out a review of their inquiry by the National Police Improvement Agency, which is a very un-American move.
I mean, it's an un-American move to have a National Police Improvement Agency.
Exactly. So first of all, and then second of all, for an agency to willingly be like, guys, I don't know, this one's really tough. Like, can you please put a second set of eyes on this to make sure we didn't miss anything? Peter Lawrence, however, didn't think that this was good enough. He wanted an independent inquiry, saying, quote, as it stands, it is the police policing police, and the MPIA's reports are only made public if the chief constable wants them to be, which is unsatisfactory. So, like, I get that point. You know? I mean, that makes sense. It's just so wild to me because it's like he is like so far ahead of any victims' family member in the U.S. that it's like, oh, come on, man. But no, good for him. He went on to say, quote, after all this time, people expect to know what the police have been and are still doing, even if some confidential operational detail has to be omitted. What is really needed now is an urgent independent inquiry with a public report. Nothing less will do, and transparency is vital if trust is to be restored in North Yorkshire Police, end quote.
Well, you did say he was a solicitor.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, that is a very lawyer thing to say.
It is. It is. And, you know, but
it's totally valid.
It's great. 100%. Good for him. I mean, I think he's being a fantastic advocate.
Yeah.
So he also wanted a new agency to take over the entire investigation with the hope that fresh eyes could lead to new breakthroughs. But the case was not turned over, and on July 29th, North Yorkshire Police confirmed that they were reducing the number of officers dedicated to Claudia's inquiry. Not much happened over the next few years until the fall of 2013, when police announced a fresh review of the case and a new forensic search of Claudia's home. Before we get into the actual search, I want to take a moment to talk about how the police were able to perform this new search of Claudia's home. I mentioned at the beginning of the episode that she had bought the Haworth cottage.
Right.
After she went missing, the bills continued to pile up, but as she was still legally alive, it was difficult for her family to handle her affairs. They eventually somehow figured it out. I don't know the details of what they ended up doing.
Well, again, her father was a solicitor, so I'm sure he was able to legally figure it out.
Well, exactly. That's what I mean. So, like, he was able to figure it out. And so they, I don't know if they, like, just took over the payments or just bought her cottage outright or whatever it was, but they were able to keep Claudia's cottage as is. So for the first 18 months of the investigation, police had exclusive access to it. After those first 18 months, which is probably around that time that
they started scaling back.
Exactly. Then it kind of went back to Claudia's family, but they kept it empty. But this whole experience, because it wasn't just the house, right? I mean, it was like, you know, her cell phone bill, like, you know, all these other bills that would have just rolled over into collections or sure. Whatever.
Yeah.
And so this led Peter to fight for a new law. The Guardianship Missing Persons Act 2017 took years to pass, but created a new legal status of guardian of the affairs of the missing person. This allows families to act in the best interests of a missing person after they have been gone for 90 days, as opposed to waiting for years until they are legally declared dead.
Oh.
So this actually didn't even go into effect until 2019. If somebody's missing for 90 days, then instead of like their car getting repossessed and their house getting foreclosed on or whatever, people can step in earlier before it starts to accrue like all those late fees and all of that kind of stuff to kind of just do whatever they need to do in the missing person's best interest.
To either pay for it on their behalf or what?
Or sell it or, you know, whatever the case may be.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I could see that going both ways.
Right. It's tough. And there's a lot more to it in terms of like how you get guardianship and, you know, things like that. But the point is that Peter did spend years kind of fighting for this just to make this process easier, because it's like, And we've covered this before where there have been financial issues and these families have to go to court to have their loved one legally declared dead. And it's just like this other awful thing that you have to go through on top of the million other awful things that you have to go through. So this might just make that a little bit easier.
Yeah.
So back to this 2013 forensic search. A major crime unit was formed at NYP around this time with the aim to take some of the investigative burden off of detectives by investigating abductions, sexual assaults, and cold cases. During this forensic search, investigators were reportedly able to use new techniques to uncover additional fingerprints from her home. Though Claudia's car had been in the shop at the time of her disappearance, they also took another look at that.
So they still had her car,
too? They still had her car, too, yeah.
Wow.
And nobody had been using it. It had just been sitting there. So it was, you know, fairly well-preserved.
Sure.
And, you know, so it was in the shop at the time, so they knew that, like, they weren't going to find any evidence of what happened that morning.
Right.
But what they did find was a cigarette butt with an unknown male DNA profile on it. Again, not directly related to the morning, but it is related to somebody that she had been spending time with.
Right. Still not conclusive that that's who was with her or seen with her on the bridge
and
whatnot, but it's somebody else who is of interest.
And more importantly, because we're talking 4 years later at this point, more importantly, it's somebody who hasn't come forward yet, because in the initial investigation, police took DNA swabs from like people they interviewed. So whoever belonged to that cigarette butt,
who had been in the car, quote unquote, weeks before she disappeared.
Yeah, was keeping quiet about it.
Yeah, got it.
Mm-hmm. So all this information was made public, and this is when we got the CCTV footage of that Ford Focus that was seen in front of Claudia's house the morning of her disappearance. Further analysis of her phone data also showed that in the weeks leading up to her disappearance, Claudia had spent time in the Acombe area of York. So it's just like a different neighborhood, basically. And she had just, in the couple weeks before, she had been there like a lot, like pretty much all of her free time. And this new phase of the investigation led to an arrest 5 years after Claudia was last seen. On May 13th, 2014, 59-year-old Michael Snelling was arrested on suspicion of murder.
59?
Yeah. What?
And she was in her mid-30s?
Yeah. According to news reports, officers cordoned off his home in York, boarded up the door, and performed an extensive forensic search, focusing not only in the house, but on the back garden and a paved area behind the garage. Snelling was reportedly arrested at a relative's house, which was also searched. Now, when this arrest was made, people were scrambling to figure out the connection to Claudia's case. Like, that first article that I got that information from, like, they didn't have any information on Snelling himself. Like, it was just like, they arrested some guy, they dug up his shit. I don't know. Now, according to a later article in the York Press, a recent Crime Watch appeal said that police were looking for a white male, age 55 to 65, about 6 feet tall, with a full head of medium-length, scruffy gray hair. He was reportedly seen at Claudia's door on the day she disappeared between 6:45 and 6:55 a.m.
That's new.
Very new, right? And I don't know.
Seen by whom?
They don't say. So apparently this is just a new tip that they've gotten. It's not on like video. I don't know.
And it's a 6 foot tall person. So not the person on the bridge who was 5'6".
Exactly. Exactly.
Or and even outside if you're, of the university. That's a huge difference.
Yeah, that's not And the person on the bridge and outside the university definitely seemed closer to Claudia's age, not between 55 and 65. I don't know how tall Snelling is. Nothing I read had his height in it. But like he generally fits the description, I guess. Like he's, I just saw like a shoulders up picture of the guy and he seems like a big dude. I mean, I don't know. But his hair was more brown than gray. And saying he had a full head of hair would be very generous. So like,
well, did he have a full head of hair? Because this arrest was made 5 years previous.
I mean, that's true. I don't know what happened to the dude in 5 years, but typically your hair doesn't go from gray to brown and with gray in it, you know, because it's not like he dyed it brown. So who is this guy and what is his connection to Claudia? It turns out that Michael Snelling had met Claudia at the University of York, where he also worked as a lab technician. He lived only about a half mile away from her and would sometimes give her a ride to work. He was also a regular at the Nag's Head pub.
Of course.
Yeah. Interestingly, Snelling appears to have been on the police's radar for a while. His home and garden were searched back in 2011, but he wasn't arrested at that time.
Was there a concrete slab in the back?
I don't know if it was there in 2011 or if that was new in 2013.
All right.
The initial interest was prompted by another patron of Nag's Head Pub who told police that he had seen Snelling and Claudia, quote, embracing at the pub. That's what led to the 2011 interest in this dude and the search and everything. They didn't find anything, obviously. And in 2013, now that the major case unit was taking a look at this, they decided to go back down that road and see if they could find anything else out. Another friend from the bar said that police came by the pub a few weeks prior to Snelling's arrest and started asking questions about what they knew about him and his relationship with Claudia. Snelling's friends and family were shocked by his arrest and said that police had it all wrong. They knew Snelling as a kind man who cared for his mother who suffered from dementia. He visited her weekly after she had to be moved to a care home. Like, they just didn't understand why police were even going after him in the first place. Although, you know, based on the theory of the crime, somebody who gave her rides to work sometimes, like, that could fit, but it doesn't fit with the witnesses from that morning, like you said. Snelling was kept in jail overnight, but then released on bail without charge. The charges were completely dismissed in November of that year. They took out a bunch of evidence from his house, you know, searched everything, and I guess found nothing because.
So why did they arrest him then?
Well, okay, let's circle back to that after I tell you these next couple things.
Maybe there's something with English law that I don't understand.
No, there definitely is. Because prior to all of the charges being dropped against Snelling, another arrest was made. 46-year-old Paul Harris was arrested in July of 2014 for perverting the course of justice, which is one of my favorite charges.
What the fuck does that mean?
It's obstruction.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's obstruction of justice, but it just sounds so much better.
Perverting the course of justice.
Yes.
You have to edit that out. Like, if we're targeting our fan base in England, like, they're going to hate this episode.
I mean, English people already know how dumb Americans are. Like, this is not going to be a shock.
That's true.
Paul Harris runs the Acombe pub where Claudia had been frequenting in the weeks leading up to her disappearance. Now, interestingly, I couldn't figure out from the articles why he was arrested. Like, it's talked about how they searched his pub, but it doesn't say what he was doing to pervert the course of justice. You know, like, he let them search. He called them idiots for doing it, but he still let them do it. And Harris was especially irritated by this entire thing, because he was one of the people initially interviewed in 2009, and he provided both his phone and DNA sample at that time. So he's not one of these like hidden mystery guys. He's been there all along. So nevertheless, police went back to his pub 5 years later with forensic experts and dogs. They removed items and dug up sections of his cellar. And he was so, it was kind of funny. He was like so pissed. He's like, the part that they dug up was a repair that was 20 years old. If they can't tell 20-year-old concrete from new concrete, then maybe they are in the wrong line of work. Yeah, but he was like super pissed because he had to close for the whole day. He's like, they're costing me money. They're digging up stuff that's like, that has nothing to do with anything. He's like, I get why they want to question me. That's fine. Because again, he cooperated with the investigation initially. He's like, but they didn't have to come in like this. They arrested him in his home. His wife was asleep. He had to like shout up to her and tell her what was happening. Like, social media went crazy. And they're like, is this guy Claudia's killer? He had two teenage kids who were like in tears because people at school kept on asking them if their dad's a murderer. Like, it seems like a disaster.
So in England, can you be arrested on suspicion of a crime?
So yes.
Because you cannot.
Yeah. And that is what is wild. And that's the biggest difference that, you know, really struck me with this is that, like, when we cover these cases that happen here in the States, you have people who are like so obviously suspects,
right,
that never get arrested
because there's not probable cause to arrest
them. And then here they're just like, I am not interested in your whole vibe, so I'm going to arrest you and we'll just like see what happens.
Wow.
Yeah. But then there's this other thing which I've learned from English police dramas, which is like a caution. So like that seems more like when you're brought in for questioning, like here in the States, and you're not arrested, but like they'll read you your rights because you're being like officially questioned.
Sure. Yeah.
And I think that's like a caution. But yeah, but like you can also just get arrested. But it does not mean that you're ever going to see like the inside of a courtroom for a trial.
Weird.
It's very strange. And it, so it doesn't end with these two. In April of 2015, just over 6 years after Claudia was last seen, three of her drinking buddies who had a running bet over who would be the next one, like jammed up over her disappearance.
Oh my God.
Yeah. It was like a running joke with them because like police had come in and like, we're arresting all these people.
But then it becomes a reality.
Yeah. They were all arrested on suspicion of murder. And that was the charge, suspicion of murder. Yes. So officers arrived at each of their homes with dogs and took them each in for questioning. And this followed a fourth friend having been arrested a week or two prior. So like they arrested the one guy like 2 weeks ago and then, you know, went and got these three guys all on the same day. All four of those men were released. Paul Harris, the bar owner, was released the same day. Michael Snelling was really the only guy who was kind of under suspicion for longer because he was arrested in May and let out on bail like the next day. He only spent a night in jail, but it was months before they actually dropped the charges against him. So like they really were trying to make a case against him from what it sounds like. After this new investigation ultimately led nowhere, though, the case went quiet once again. That is until 2017 when the serial killer theory reemerged. Stephen Fulcher was the lead investigator on the murder of Sean O'Callaghan. On March 19th, 2011, she left a Swindon nightclub around 3 a.m. and started to walk home. A taxi driver pulled up alongside her, like a real taxi driver, licensed and everything, and, you know, just asked if she needed a ride. Given that he was a taxi driver, she accepted. That driver was a man named Christopher Hollowell. He was later convicted of murdering Sean. Hollowell was ultimately convicted of another murder, that of Becky Godden Edwards, but has been linked to many other sexual assaults, disappearances, and murders. In 2017, Fulcher, the investigator, wrote a book about Sean's case, and in it, he floated the theory of a possible connection between Hollowell and Claudia. Apparently, the date March 19th, in addition to being the date of both Sean's murder and Claudia's disappearance, factors into several of the other crimes of which he is suspected.
So are they able to put him in that location, though?
So that was the problem, because there certainly are parallels.
Yeah. For sure.
He was in the general area, but they just really couldn't tie him to the actual location.
What's his height?
He looks tall in pictures. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm just curious if he's 5'6".
Yeah, I don't know. They couldn't really tie him. And so they're just like, oh, well, that's a theory, whatever. It didn't go anywhere. However, in 2021, another investigator wrote a book about Hollowell and also brought up the possibility of a connection. The authors of this book believed that Hollowell could be behind a series of murders credited to the East Lynx Ripper, a killer who murdered and sexually mutilated three women. In total, they were looking at 27 additional murders that they believed could be attributed to Hollowell.
I'm curious what Hollowell's MO was, as far as how did they find the bodies? And not the theory of 27 additional. Like, how did they find?
Yeah. So Sean O'Callaghan was taken out to just a remote location. She was murdered. He just kind of left her there, covered her up, I think, but didn't really like work hard to dispose of the body, which I think, you know, is why he was caught so quickly.
Sure.
For the other one, she was partially dismembered and buried. And then, like I said, the other ones that they suspect him of, the women were sexually mutilated. I'm not sure how their bodies were found, but there are a few others that he's suspected of where the bodies were not found at all. So
I get where they're going with it, but typically in serial killers, their MO kind of stays the same, kind of. It can change. Yes, I know. But they usually get better at the craft.
Yeah,
and less careless. So the one he got caught for, like, she was just left in a field, basically. Like, that doesn't seem like somebody that had been doing this for years.
It could be a case of them, like Israel Keyes or you know, the confession killer, like, all of, you know, just trying to close all these cases and kind of...
Yeah.
Just put on like the one boogeyman kind of thing.
Wrap it up.
Yeah. So I don't know. But and so even after this second book in 2021, like not much came out of it in relation to Claudia's case. But just days before we're recording this, it was the 14th anniversary of Claudia's disappearance. And Joan publicly requested that police question Hollowell about Claudia. Back in 2017, like we said, no one could really connect Hollowell to North Yorkshire, where Claudia lived. But now Joan claims that there are three witnesses who can do just that. One claimed that Hollowell stalked her near Pickering, while another says she recognized his evil, piercing eyes. So basically, according to three different women who had encounters with this guy, like, he was in the area around that time. Whether he was there on March 19th, you know, 2009 is a different story. But it's more of a connection than it seems like they had in 2017 when this was first brought up.
Sure. I mean, worth talking to him about it.
Well, exactly.
I mean, I feel like it would be worth talking to him about it back in 2017, just because what other leads are you following at that time?
Well, and so it sounds like when Hollowell was arrested and a lot of evidence was uncovered, that I don't know if they talked to him about Claudia or what, but they did talk to Joan, police did, because in this interview from a few days ago, she asked to see evidence that they had recovered in 2014. This is called a treasure trove, and it's over 60 items, including Sean's boots, a shotgun, and other articles of women's clothing.
His trophies.
Exactly. Hollowell also had over a dozen sketches of beauty spots, so like basically scenic areas, that police believe could be potential burial sites. Joan has seen photos of the clothing that was recovered in 2014, but she says that the quality of the photos wasn't very good, and she's asking to see them physically in front of her. She believes that there's a possibility that she could see a clue or recognize something that, you know, the police missed or that she even missed when she was just looking at the photos. And, you know, again, this was literally days ago, so we don't know what's happening with all that.
Yeah.
But this feeling of like perhaps police or, you know, somebody's missing something is a feeling that she's had for a while. Last year, around the 13th anniversary, when she spoke to reporters, Joan said, quote, "I just feel there's something obvious we are all missing. I feel everything needs examining again, from her house to local searches on the street where she lived. We need to go back to square one, talk to potential witnesses, people who live nearby or who came forward but wasn't listened to at the time. All the original forensics need reexamining," end quote. Yes. But I think to an extent they've been doing that.
Yeah. And also at this point, this is how many years later?
Well, at the time of that interview, it was 13. Now it's 14.
Right. So going back to talk to witnesses 14 years later, 13 years, 14 years later, like you're just basically going, you're guaranteed to get misinformation.
Okay, yeah, if you're talking about it from the perspective of somebody who might have seen something that morning, I think what she's talking more about, and I think what would be valuable, are re-interviewing people and people who would finally like say, oh shit, fine, whatever, it's been 14 years, yeah, I was sleeping with her, or yeah, my husband,
okay, you know, yeah, sure.
That kind of information,
sure.
I think could help put, like, fill in some of the blanks here. But Joan also wonders if nearby buildings that had been under construction back in 2009 were properly examined and if the workers were thoroughly questioned. Now, in terms of the workers, there's not really much you can do about that 14 years later. But the question of the buildings under construction is an interesting one. The last major search for Claudia was performed in early 2021 when police drained a lake at Sand Hutton Gravel Pits near York, about 8 miles from Claudia's home. This came after a chilling note was found underneath a laminated missing poster. Underneath the poster was a small bouquet of flowers and a note that said in block letters, "She's in the water," with two arrows. There was also a separate note that said, "God bless her." So that's terrifying and definitely led police to look for the nearest body of water that those arrows were pointing to and take a look. So they drained this pond, but didn't find anything. But when all of this was happening, you know, between the finding of the note and the draining of the water, you know, the family was cautiously, I don't think optimistic is the right word, but
no, not in this case,
you know,
but yes.
Because they've gotten their hopes up so many times before, yeah, with all the arrests, with everything. But for this one, Peter Lawrence was never able to find out the results of that search. He passed away on Valentine's Day, 2021, at the age of 74. He fought tirelessly for his daughter for nearly 12 years. And with his passing, Joan has now stepped into the forefront. Despite being nearly 80 herself now, Joan is not giving up on her child. She told the BBC in 2022, quote, "I have had hope so many times and it's been dashed. I never give up on hope. If you give up on hope, you might as well give up altogether. It's the not knowing. Despite the fact she was 35, she is my child. You can't say goodbye. You don't know whether she's dead. You don't know if she's alive. You don't know where she is. You don't know what's happened to her. There's no grave. It's still pretty awful. It really is. End quote. So yeah, there are still people who have information about Claudia who have not come forward. You know, as far as we know, the person who left that cigarette butt in her car has never been identified. There are still prints that were found in her house in 2013 that have never been identified. People are very clearly holding back. And I think, you know, one of the tragedies is not only are there people that you know are holding back information, but that in the 14 years, the news coverage of this has been very like, she was with 12 men and, you know, she was like dating all these married men. And her friends are like, it wasn't really like that. Like, yeah, I mean, she had some flings, she did whatever, but it wasn't like she was only going after married men or like anything like that. Like, things happened.
Right. And you said that that was over the course of like many years.
Yeah.
It wasn't like within the month of her disappearance, she was with these 12 men.
Yeah. It wasn't anything like that. And it's like, she was seeing people, she was dating, like she was an adult. You know, she could just
living her life.
Exactly. Right. And so, like, I think there was just a lot of judgment there.
I mean, yeah, it's victim blaming.
Exactly. And that's upsetting. And her family does feel that kind of like tainted the investigation at the beginning. You know, I think as the investigation went on, it became more of a practical matter of like these people not talking. But yeah, I think there was a lot of judgment in the beginning that they do believe harmed the investigation. So, you know, it's a tough one because like this case feels very solvable because it does sound like she was harmed by somebody she knew, somebody she was likely romantically involved with. Somebody probably has an idea of who that might've been, you know?
I'm also curious what level of searching, like physical searches, were done.
She
went missing.
You know, in terms of like the first days, I'm not sure. I'm a little bit fuzzy on that.
I mean, that happens
exactly
here too.
But in general, it sounds like they did some pretty extensive physical searches. It is frustrating that there are still people out there, presumably choosing not to talk about this for their own selfish reasons, because they don't, not because they had anything to do with her disappearance, but because they don't want to harm a relationship. But what they don't know is that, you know, the information that they do have could help fill in the blanks, could help put the puzzle together.
It could narrow the search.
It could. And, you know, by withholding this information that you may think isn't relevant, you could be harming the investigation and contributing to this family's endless pain. 14 years is long enough. It's time to talk. Claudia Lawrence has been missing from Haworth, York, England, since March 19, 2009. She is a white female with brown hair and brown eyes. She was last seen carrying a gray backpack. Claudia was 35 when she went missing. She would be 49 today. Anyone with information who could assist the investigation into Claudia Lawrence's disappearance should make a report via the North Yorkshire Police website or by calling 101 and selecting option 1. You can also contact Crime Stoppers UK anonymously on 0800-555-111 or through their anonymous form on their website. No personal details are taken, information cannot be traced or recorded, and you will not go to court. You can see all the sources for this episode along with photos and videos on our website and thentheyweregone.com.
and be sure to follow us on social. And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. Our research, writing, and editing is done by Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketsa. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!
The holidays are almost here, and if you still have names on your list, don't panic. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. You'll discover presents that feel meaningful and personal, never rushed or last minute. Uncommon Goods looks for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade or made in the U.S., so every gift feels special and thoughtfully chosen. Here are a few things that I'm getting. Unlock the Beer Escape Room. It's a cute little cage that you could put a 6-pack of beer in, and then you have to do an escape room to get the code to open the cage. I am absolutely getting this for my brother-in-law because this is in his wheelhouse in every way. The DIY Root Beer Science Kit I'm getting for my 8-year-old because he has recently discovered root beer and he likes learning. So this is going to be a really fun project for the both of us. So don't wait. Make this holiday the year you give something truly unforgettable. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/ATTWG. That's uncommongoods.com/ATTWG for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods. We're all out of the ordinary.